Episode 4, Vaccines, Examining Influenza, the HIV and Pneumococcal Vaccines and Herd Immunity.
Vaccines. This is episode number 4. Have you ever had a flu vaccine? The flu shot's currently being recommended for elderly all the way down to infants. And most infants, the day they're born, receive a vitamin K shot. But what's the long-term impact of this vaccine? Learn the answer to these questions and many more in tonight's episode. I hope you enjoy it. In this episode, we're going to cover several topics in depth, so let's get rolling. First up is influenza, also known as the flu, which is the most common infectious disease. Influenza A and B are the two types of influenza viruses that cause epidemic human disease. According to the World Health Organization, 20 to 30% of children and 5 to 10% of adults come down with the flu each year. Usually the flu is a manageable illness, but serious complications can occur, even death.
The CDC and the FDA often claim that 36,000 people die every year from influenza. This is a flat out lie. If you actually go to the CDC's, MMWR's, morbidity and mortality weekly reports, they publish weekly and annual reports on how many people die from influenza. And in any given year, the average is anywhere from 750 to 2,000 people that succumb to influenza. And most of these people have had pre-existing conditions, okay? So they've had pre-existing health conditions that made them more susceptible to some other opportunistic disease that they've been exposed to. Okay.
So where did the CDC get the 36,000?
They make it up.
Recently, the CDC changed the 36,000 flu deaths per year figure and instead says that the death toll ranges from 3,300 to 49,000. One of the statistical issues is that the CDC places deaths from pneumonia along with deaths from the flu into the same category. On the CDC website, we see 55,220 deaths from influenza and pneumonia. When I open up the source document, which is the National Vital Statistics Reports, there's a breakout of deaths, and we see that only 4,605 of the 55,000 deaths were actually attributable to the flu. This was actually a very high number of influenza deaths compared to previous years, where flu deaths were as low as 500 in 2010. The two primary delivery systems for the flu vaccines are the injectable, which is the shot, and the inhaled flu mist.
They just took the inhaled influenza shot off the market because it was only 3% effective last year.
I read that.
That's pretty bad. And it wasn't that great beforehand, and it was spreading, influenza. Just read the package insert. But when it comes to the injected vaccine, if you are naive to a certain strain of that virus, and that virus is the one that you encounter, and you've been given that vaccine that year, and you had an immune response to it, yes, it can protect you that year. Okay, but the story doesn't end there. So what happens after you're vaccinated, and there are studies, Hayward and Bodewies, I think these both came out in 2013 or 2014, which explains in great detail with really good studies that if you're vaccinated with an injected trivalent influenza vaccine, what that will do is it will stir up the immune system to create massive amounts of antibody towards those particular strains. Great, right? Well, what happens is that the antibody arm of the immunity and the cell-mediated arm of immunity usually work in synergy, and they work together. And it's not like either one of them is bad, but what happens after a vaccine is the antibody arm gets really ramped up. Well, that actually feeds back into the cellular arm and the memory arm, so that those antibodies that are created actually paralyze the immune system from creating memory immunity and cell-mediated immunity. And that's just a well-known, documented fact.
You know what the CDC said last year, Ty, remember? Oh, guess what, everyone? We messed up. The flu strain that we put in the flu shot this year wasn't the right one. Of course it's not the right one, because how many thousands and thousands? Now we don't even know how many potential flu strains are.
The CDC did admit that the 2014 flu vaccine was ineffective, because the virus had mutated. The Cochrane Collaboration is an international not-for-profit organization comprised of independent researchers. Their role is to establish an evidence base for health and medical care by assessing the published literature to determine whether interventions like surgery, medical drugs, and nutritional supplements are effective at treating particular conditions. The work of the Cochrane Collaboration, which is published in Cochrane Reviews, is internationally recognized as the benchmark for high-quality information about the effectiveness of healthcare. So what is the Cochrane Collaboration's position on vaccines?
I started to look into vaccines because I was surprised. You know, when I looked at the what they call meta-analysis of all the literature ever published on vaccines, there's a particular independent scientific body called the Cochrane Collaboration, highly respected, because what they do is they look at all the studies, they try to really identify if there's, say, industry influence. Because as you know, there's no real regulation as far as publishing studies. If you have a null or negative finding, you don't have to publish it. But if you have a positive one, you could be a vaccine manufacturer and spend 20 years and finally get a study that looks like, okay, there's a little bit of a relative risk reduction in some disease. And you publish that, and then that's all you see. Well, what they did, they looked at all the research on childhood vaccines and all the research on vaccines for healthy adults and elderly and those who work on the elderly. And none of the Cochrane review conclusions showed that they were proven safe or effective.
What got me started on down the rabbit hole in the vaccine issue is that the school, I was at BU, and you know, it was all about, oh, flu vaccine clinics, we have to model this as a disaster plan. And I was like, flu vaccine, God, you know, like nothing I've read have said that it's very effective. And so I started looking at the data, and I was looking at the Cochrane Collaboration. I had never really known about Cochrane before. Right. As a physician, never heard about Cochrane.
What
I wasn't
is the Cochrane Collaboration?
So the Cochrane Collaboration is an independent group of international researchers, MDs, masters, PhDs, who work mostly voluntarily. Most of them are volunteer, and there's no industry money coming in at all. So they will not take any money that's related or tied even down the road to industry. So it's truly independent research, and it's collaborative. And the Cochrane Collaboration had put out almost every year a paper on a meta-analysis, meaning they're looking at all the different studies and they do a meta-analysis of the data, and show that, you know, the flu vaccine was barely effective, if at all, and that, you know, in any given year, for every 100 patients who are told they have flu, 7 actually have influenza. You know, so influenza is not even as you know, as prevalent as we think. You know, people say, I have the flu. It just means they had, you know, a viral syndrome with maybe a fever and respiratory
they
symptoms.
They didn't feel well, so they had the flu.
Right, but it's not influenza, right? And even when we have influenza, it's always a guess, right? So the bottom line is that I looked at the data and I went to the head of my department and I said, you know, the department's spending so much time and effort training the master's students on how to run a flu vaccine clinic. When you gotta look at this data, it doesn't make any sense. And so the head of my department, who's also part of DARPA, you know, he's a military guy, looked at it and he said, ooh, he actually said expletives, but you know, because they had spent time doing this and he had just like written a paper and he said, you know, you're right. And right after that, there was a conference in DC going on called Selling Sickness. And I said, we gotta go to this conference. Because Peter Doshi's going to be there. Peter Doshi had been working with Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson, not the president, but Tom Jefferson, who's an MD, PhD, head of Cochrane Collaboration on upper respiratory infection, which means he analyzes a lot of vaccine safety and effectiveness, mostly effectiveness or lack thereof. And he was the one who's really heading up all the flu vaccine studies. And Peter Doshi was working with him. And Peter's thing was really Tamiflu. But because at the time there was this whole swine flu epidemic.
Right.
And when I'm doing quotes,
2008,
because
2009.
It was 2009, 2010.
Okay.
And it was, I'm doing quotes around that because, you know, even, I think it was the BMJ or the Lancet even called out the WHO for changing the definition of a worldwide pandemic. In the summer that year, they changed the definition to make everyone believe that we were having this major pandemic. It was not a pandemic and it was not a lethal virus, but it was to sell flu vaccine and Tamiflu. And it turned out that the WHO had been taking advice from a group called ESWI. It was a small group of physicians who were all working either for the makers of Tamiflu or the maker of the swine flu vaccine.
So a little conflict of interest there.
Big conflict of interest. But so this is stuff that came out during this conference that really opened my eyes and certainly opened the head of my department's eyes.
In 2010, the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices began recommending the flu vaccine for all healthy children older than 6 months. This was an expansion that they claimed was, and I quote, supported by evidence that annual influenza vaccination is a safe and effective preventative health action with potential benefits in all age groups. Yet a July 2012 Cochrane Collaboration systematic review concluded that for kids that were under the age of two, the currently licensed vaccines are, and I quote, not significantly more efficacious than a placebo. In kids older than two, the Cochrane analysis indicates that the flu shot reduces the absolute risk that a child will catch the flu by about 3.6%. A February 17, 2010 Cochrane Collaboration systematic review indicated that, and I quote, the available evidence is of poor quality and provides no guidance regarding the safety, efficacy, or effectiveness of influenza vaccines for people aged 65 years or older. To resolve the uncertainty, an adequately powered, publicly funded, randomized, placebo-controlled trial run over several seasons should be undertaken. On the package insert for Flulaval vaccine, it states, and I quote, there have been no controlled trials adequately demonstrating a decrease in influenza after vaccination with Flulaval. There is one recent study from 2012 where a true saline placebo was used rather than another vaccine or a carrier that contained everything except the main antigen.
There are studies that use saline. One that I mention often was by Cowling in 2013, and what they did is, and this is to me exemplifies why saline is not used as a placebo. They did a really good study where they vaccinated something like 100 people with trivalent influenza vaccine and gave a saline placebo to another 100, and then they actually followed them over the winter, and any time there was any upper respiratory infection, they cultured them and figured out what it was. And what they found was that there really wasn't a huge difference in the influenza viral infections, but depending on which strain, it could have gone either way. But what was really stuck out in my mind is that there was a 4 to 5 times higher incidence of non-influenza viral infections in the vaccinated, and with some very nasty viruses that would have been called polio in the old days. So that's, you know, in my opinion, they know this, and they know that there would be a huge skew between the placebo and the vaccinated, both in safety and efficacy, if they did studies this way, and that's why it's not done.
Interestingly, I wrote a letter to ACOG, the American Academy of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, stating, you know, I understand you recommend the flu shot, could you at least recommend the single dose vial? It's mercury free. They wrote me back and said, we believe thimerosal to be safe. I said, okay, here is a picture of the bottle. It's got a skull and crossbones on it. And here's the MSDS sheet, which is a material safety data sheet by the company that says it's a mutagen for mammalian somatic cells. So in layman terms, it causes mutations in mammalian, mammals, somatic germ cells, so eggs. So it causes mutations at the level of dividing germ cells, like an embryo. Hello? I said, what about this doesn't bother you? Well, we don't believe. I said, so do your scientists have data that the manufacturer of thimerosal doesn't have? Because here's a skull and crossbones, and here's their MSDS sheet. And they were like, thank you, have a good day.
Dr. Bart mentioned that the MSDS, the material safety data sheet, for the flu vaccine shows that it is a mutagen. In other words, it changes DNA. Did you know that most vaccines, including the flu vaccine, Flulaval, have never been tested for mutagenicity or carcinogenicity? This means that they have not tested to see if they change or mutate DNA or if they cause cancer. When somebody says mercury, we immediately think of the news stories about a kid at school that broke a thermometer in biology class and the hazmat team is called in and all the students are scared to death. I remember this happened to me when I was in elementary school in Garland, Texas back in the 1970s. I think I was about 7 years old. In the previous episode, we learned from experts about vaccines that still contain trace amounts of thimerosal, which is 50% ethyl mercury. Are there still vaccines that contain more than merely trace amounts of thimerosal?
Wasn't thimerosal removed from the vaccines in 2003?
That's what I've read.
Yeah, thimerosal was removed from three childhood vaccines in 2003, but the same year, CDC mandated flu vaccines for pregnant women and for little children. And the flu vaccines at that time, almost all of them contained megadoses of thimerosal. So children who were receiving vaccines after 2003 could get as much thimerosal as children prior to 2003, prior to the removal in 2003 from those other three vaccines. And for the first time, they began giving it to pregnant women. So children were getting thimerosal at a much more vulnerable period of their lives. So it's kind of a myth to say that thimerosal was removed from vaccines. It was removed from some vaccines, but it was added to others.
They put it into multi-dose vials because if you have to put 10 needles into the same vial, it's cheaper to produce. Once you produce the vaccine, it's cheaper to put 10 doses into one vial than it is to put one dose into one vial. And when they do that, they put the mercury in it as an antimicrobial agent because
preserve it.
Yeah, you're putting 10 needles in it. So it saves about 15 cents per dose.
Multiply that out times billions of doses.
Yeah, they're saving lots of money. But if you think about it another way, do you think your child is worth 15 cents?
Yeah.
If the difference is between getting toxic mercury and not getting toxic mercury and it's 15 cents, that's the difference?
When I interviewed Neil Miller and he asked this question about whether a parent would purchase a vaccine with mercury in it in order to save 15 cents, I thought that was a rhetorical question and that nobody in their right mind would do that. However, I recently visited Washington, D.C., and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and his team, we met with several congressmen and congresswomen to discuss this very topic, specifically the multi-dose flu vaccine, which still contains thimerosal or mercury. We had an incredible meeting with Congressman Posey and his entire team. I'm not at liberty to mention his name, but we also met with a congressman who told us that since he always pinches pennies, that he would opt for a cheaper vaccine with mercury in it if it saved him some money. While I was in Washington, D.C., I met with several mothers who have children with gastrointestinal issues and also autoimmune disorders.
There was a study in the Journal of Vaccine back in 2012 that looked at the injection of the flu vaccine into pregnant mothers. No one had ever measured what happens to the immune system. And what they found was that by injecting the flu vaccine into pregnant mothers, there was an increased circulation of inflammatory immune markers. But no one really understood what those inflammatory markers actually meant to a growing fetus. There are studies in the literature that clearly say schizophrenic disorders, psychiatric disorders, and autism have all been found to have as its precursors a history of inflammation in utero.
We understand that autism, for example, is an inflammatory condition.
Dr. Paul Thomas.
A study back in, I think it was 2005, showed universally autistic kids at autopsy had brain inflammation. They just looked at motor vehicle accident kids who happened to be autistic and had some controls who weren't, and there was a huge difference. So inflammation is part of the process. We want to avoid inflammation. There was a study that showed, I think it was the flu shot in pregnancy causes an increase in CRP, which is an inflammatory marker. So right there, that's telling me that's probably not wise to be injecting a vaccine that causes inflammation in the womb when we know there's another study that shows inflammation in the womb is associated with increased autism risk.
In some states, if a doctor takes that multi-dose vial and drops it by mistake on the floor and it breaks, he is required by law to evacuate the building and to bring in hazmat crews to clean it up before the building can be reoccupied. Hazmat crews wearing moon suits and respirators. So, and we're taking that same toxin. And flu vaccines have to be treated as a hazardous waste if you're going to dispose of them. That thimerosal vial is legally a hazardous waste. It can't be disposed of in a garbage can. Yeah, we're taking that and we're injecting it into pregnant women and little babies. reason, and if it's early in the pregnancy, which is recommended under the current advisories, a little baby could be getting as much as a million times what EPA says is safe.
Let's figure out exactly how much Tamiflu is in the multi-dose flu vaccine. The multi-dose flu vaccine has 25 micrograms of Tamiflu. The shot is 0.5 milliliters, so let's do some math.
So 25 micrograms in a 0.5 milliliter shot, same thing as 25 micrograms in a 0.0005 liter shot, or 250,000 micrograms in 5 liters, or 50,000 micrograms per liter. Well, 1 microgram per liter is the same thing as 1 part per billion, therefore, the shot has 50,000 parts per billion of Tamiflu. Now remember that 2 parts per billion of mercury is the mandated limit in drinking water, and normally 200 parts per billion would label something as a toxic hazard. So the multi-dose flu shot has 250 times the allowable limit of mercury in a toxic hazard. Regardless of your position on the flu vaccine, does the way that they're currently marketing it alarm you? Here's a video that I took with my iPhone when I was down in Austin, Texas last year. I was really surprised about how the flu vaccine is being marketed right alongside of beer, wine, and Coca-Cola. Do you remember the swine flu epidemic from 2009?
What happened in 2009, if you remember, there was the swine flu vaccine and there was the seasonal influenza vaccine. And so a lot of people got 2 shots that year. And my guess is that that's why more things happened, at least in my sphere. And so the first event was a fellow that was brought in from the outside after having had normal kidney function, and he was on dialysis and told me that he was fine until he had that shot. And I said, "What shot?" And he said, "That vaccine." And I thought, well, that's really interesting. So I looked into it some more, and I was like, sure enough, it sure seems logical and likely because your kidney function was normal before. And so this happened again and again, so 3 times. And I thought, well, my administration's really going to want to know about this. So I was really kind of, you know, submit the next time I saw the chief of medicine in the hallway, I made sure I told him, and he just kind of stiffened up and stood back and was like, "It's not from the vaccine." And I thought, why would you say that? You know, you never say that about an ACE inhibitor or a cholesterol drug or an antibiotic that's shutting down the kidneys. Why all of a sudden is it impossible for a vaccine to do this? And so my claims were denied, and I thought, well, that's all right, I'm just going to carry on, whatever. And so I decided to start asking the question of my inpatients and my outpatients, when was your last vaccine? And sure enough, I started to notice a correlation between either new onset kidney dysfunction or failure or worsening of old very rapidly. So at that point, I started to keep notes and start remembering names and events. And I kept a list of how many times this happened. And I went again to the administration. I said, look, there's even more evidence. Look, this one guy had this level of kidney function, which was normal when he came into the hospital. You gave him a flu shot within 24 hours. And look, now his kidney function went down within 24 hours. And the internists are chasing their tails trying to find a cause. It's the vaccine. It's very well known that if you've got a flu shot 1 year, well, it might help you if you're one of those few people that it does. I think you have to vaccinate like, you know, 100 people to, you know, prevent the flu and a handful. If you're one of those people, the following year, you're likely to be more susceptible to a pandemic if it comes through. And again, that's been shown in reality in populations, and it's been shown experimentally.
Wait. People don't know is that CDC on their own website have now admitted that in the last 10 years, the flu shot doesn't work half the time, and in some years, it doesn't work at all. And that's their own information, okay? About 75% of people who get vaccinated can still get infected with the flu. They can still pass the flu on to influenza on to other people. But you know, in this country, most of the symptoms that we have during the winter, what they call the flu season, coughing, runny nose, fever, are not due to type A or type B influenza. Only about 20% of those symptoms actually are type A or type B influenza. And every year, the government tries to guess which strains of influenza are going to be circulating. Lots of times they don't guess right. But you still take a risk when you get that flu vaccination. There also were studies that show that children who have had seasonal influenza shots actually are more likely to get infected when a pandemic flu strain comes around. That occurred in 2009.
There was a study out of Canada, I think it was last year, where they looked at people who had gotten the flu shot every year compared to people who hadn't gotten the flu shot, and how did they respond to a new flu virus, right? Because they're always trying to predict what's going to be the next flu virus. Those who had not been getting those yearly vaccines were much less likely to be infected by a new strain. So there's something about over-vaccinating that actually harms your ability to fight other infections.
On the CDC's website, they state that the flu vaccine is 50 to 60% effective among the overall population during seasons when most circulating flu viruses are like the vaccine viruses. Neil Miller just stated that the flu virus is constantly mutating. So what is the probability that the virus strain in the vaccine is like the virus strain that's currently circulating? Neil wasn't the only person to mention long-term benefits from exposure to the influenza virus.
Early on, we want to be exposed to childhood illnesses because they're actually part of the developmental process of the immune system. So there was an interesting study that just came out. It was in Science Magazine, November 2016. And it's saying that, I actually love the summary, it says it right here, the first influenza attack that a child suffers can affect the way that their lifelong immunity to the virus builds up. What they found is there's an actual imprinting process that happens, that when we're exposed to the virus, it imprints our whole neuroimmune system so that later on we'll recognize that and we've got that handled. And so they found that in older individuals who were exposed to the viruses as youngsters, it meant that they were less susceptible when they were older.
What's your opinion of flu shot?
Well, it makes no sense. And here's why. Number one, the virus most likely to cause the flu.
Dr. Larry Pilevsky.
Is rarely an influenza virus. The incidence of actual influenza virus illness is very, very low. Most illnesses that lead to flu-like symptoms are not caused by the influenza virus. The vaccine itself is toxic. When people say they got the vaccine and got the flu anyway, no. They got poisoned. And the body's response to being poisoned is to get sick, to remove the poisons, because you were injected with poisons. For those people who don't get sick after the flu vaccine, the materials stay inside, or if they're lucky, they'll just excrete them out without being affected.
A few years ago, I saw a patient who came into the hospital with chest pain, and it turned out they actually had a small heart attack and went on to have an angiogram and have a stent placed. But in talking to that person, I was asking the questions, what happened just prior to your symptoms of chest pain? And what she said was she had a flu shot 6 hours before the start of chest pain. And the reality is, doctors are not asking the questions about what happened. They're not asking the questions about what preceded these events, and we have to do that. This woman told me that she had the symptoms 6 hours after the vaccine, and it is clear as day. So I reported that to the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, the government's reporting system.
Dr. Jack Wolfson, WOLFSONDO.
As physicians, we need to ask the questions.
Flu shot, it's a crapshoot. There's no real safety or efficacy studies done, and they're adding more and more of the adjuvants.
Dr. Robert Scott Bell, B-E-L-L.
So-called antibodies to back to the strains of the flu that they're guessing via a Democratic vote or a dartboard throw
right.
Each year at CDC and elsewhere. It's just an absolute nonsense. They don't even know what the flu really is. And of course, liver congestion can create the flu. Digestive upset can create the flu. It isn't just one germ each time or one virus each time. So for me, the flu shot is one of the worst examples of the marketing of something that is absolutely worthless and useless and dangerous into existence to be accepted every year. Have you gotten yours? As if it's mine. It's not mine, it's not yours, it's not anybody's, but it's marketing words. You didn't get your shot.
Right.
You know how they use this? It's very carefully selected words to make it seem like it's part of you. It's not. How would you reject what's yours? It's not yours. It's not mine. Stop it.
I just had a family this last week. Four family members all got the flu shot, all sick as dogs with the flu. I mean, we tested them. It was positive, influenza A. So this year, at least for that family, the flu shot did not protect them at all. And that's the thing. You can look at the CDC data for how protective, how effective the flu shot has been, and it's running around 30-40%. I mean, how'd you like that to be your contraceptive? It's just not very effective.
So this is a very big issue for medical staff, personnel, people who work in hospitals. Doctors, nurses have been fired for refusing to take the flu vaccine. There's some cases where a nurse died, a young, healthy 22-year-old, I forgot her name, died shortly after receiving a flu vaccine, she got very sick within hours of having it and died shortly after that. So these are people who essentially forced, but certainly pushed into having a vaccine. Others lose their job. I have had contention with hospitals that I've worked at in terms of getting a flu vaccine. I haven't had the flu vaccine in over 10 years. So why do I not get the flu vaccine? The only time I've ever felt sick is after getting a flu vaccine. I haven't had the flu or had a serious illness in over a decade.
I have several nurses who have never gotten the flu shot, and one of them, I won't use her name because she likes her confidentiality, she's never been sick. She's never had the flu. She eats well, she watches her diet, she gets her sleep, she exercises, and she doesn't get vaccines. And she's never sick. She's always at work. She's been working for me for over 20 years. And she's around all these sick kids. I used to tell her year after year, oh, you're gonna regret it, because I was getting the flu shot, right? Oh, you're gonna regret it because you're gonna be exposed. Well, of course she was exposed. How come she didn't get sick? She had a robust immune system. That's what we need.
It's interesting that Dr. Paul Thomas, who's a board-certified pediatrician, has several nurses who won't get the flu shot and they never get sick. While I was interviewing Dr. Thomas, he discussed the topic of quality measures and the pressure that's placed on pediatricians to vaccinate according to the full CDC schedule. He also mentioned the financial incentives that are in place to make sure that pediatricians do vaccinate.
One thing that as a pediatrician I'm subjected to is quality measures. And if you're a pediatrician, the health plans who have set out quality measures invariably have one, two, or even several quality measures that are basically how well are you vaccinating. So I just got a report, for example, from one of the health plans this past week that had my vaccine status level at zero. Okay, and I can tell you that probably 95% of my patients are vaccinated, but they're not. The zero is because almost none of them have done the hepatitis B vaccine because they're not at risk for that one. And that automatically puts you in the unvaxxed category. So there's this pressure on doctors to do them all now, follow the schedule. This keeps you in line with quality measures, recommendations from the CDC, recommendations from the AAP. It's a lot of pressure on doctors to conform to the one-size-fits-all that you were talking about. We need quality standards that look at what's your autism rate, what's your ADD, your anxiety rate, your diabetes rate, your asthma, your eczema, your hospitalizations, your ER visits, your clinic visits, you know, all these real quality measures that look at the health of the population. And I would love for those studies to be set up, and let's look at the differences in populations that are highly vaccinated, selectively vaccinated, or unvaccinated. Follow them and look at long-term outcomes, and then we'll have some quality data that's worth, you know, going shouting at the mountaintop.
Pediatricians and doctors aren't, what I found is that they don't read the science. You know, that they for them, CDC is a judicious arbiter of the science. So if CDC says there's no evidence, they're not going through the abstracts and going out to PubMed and looking up hundreds of documents and trying to make up their own mind. And I understand that because it's a lot of work. I mean, it took us 3 years to do this book. And we had some really great scientists and doctors looking at it. And, you know, it's hard to figure out how much weight to give to individual studies, et cetera. So people just accept CDC's word that this is all safe. And then there are very, very strong financial incentives for doctors to get their patients to comply with the CDC schedule. Doctors are punished financially and very dramatically. Insurance companies like Blue Cross Blue Shield, if they don't get a certain percentage of their patients to comply with the schedule. If 63% are not compliant, they don't get any of their bonuses. If a pediatrician does not persuade his patients to comply with the CDC schedule, he suffers a terrible, terrible financial punishment from Blue Cross Blue Shield.
This year, in the Blue Cross Blue Shield handbook that came out, it actually talked about something called the Combo 10, that in a pediatrician's office, if they have all the children under the age of 2 that have been fully vaccinated with all 10 of these vaccines called the Combo 10 by their second birthday, the vaccination rate in the pediatrician's office needs to be 63% of their entire practice needs to be fully vaccinated by this Combo 10. And if they are, they are rewarded by Blue Cross Blue Shield at $400 per child, per eligible member. So if you've got 1,000 kids in your practice and 63% of them are fully vaccinated, you get 1,000 times 400 in terms of a bonus from Blue Cross Blue Shield for following through on their standard.
When my son was born, my wife and I, we were taking the kid to the pediatrician, and she pulled out the needle, and she didn't even talk to us about it. That's why I thought it was kind of weird. She pulled out the needle and was like, we're about to get ready to do his vaccines. And we were kind of like, well, hold on. We didn't want to do it. And like, she kind of just immediately snapped, like got angry and basically like fired us like right in and there. And like, I was kind of hurt because, you know, she was kind of with us the whole time. Like we kind of looked at her. She came to the baby shower. So, you know what I mean? Like we looked at her as she was like kind of a part of the family, and she kind of just threw us to the side and was angry. She was just angry at the fact that, that she opened it. That's kind of the reason why she was like, well, I have to pay for it now, so what's going on? And we were like, well, you know, we need more time to think about it. And she kept trying to bully us to do it, and you know, she literally just threw it down, walked out the office, and told us to get out. Right after that, the nurse came in, and she was talking to us about it. She was a little bit more in tune to us. She was like around our age, so she was a little bit more in tune, where she was like, well, yeah, I understand what you guys are going through. She was like, well, maybe just think about it. So I asked her a question. I was like, did you vaccinate your kids? She said no. And I was just, you know, completely shocked that she would tell me to do it, but she wouldn't do it. And you wouldn't, like, would you tell, I wanted to ask our pediatrician, like, well, would you tell your daughter to do it? And but you're forcing us to do it? But she was just mad at the fact that she opened it and it had to be paid for. I honestly thought they cared about us. Like, I honestly thought they had their best interest, but I just felt like at that point, like you were just looking out for yourself. Like you didn't even care about our opinions. Didn't want to hear it or nothing.
Clearly, patients are not being listened to by the physician. In the
Dr. Jack Wolfson.
It used to be all about the
D.O.
when doctors would take a good history, take a good long physical examination on these people. Now it's all about the doctor. How does the doctor get that patient out of the exam room, out of the emergency room, out of the hospital as fast as possible? The patient's needs are not being met. Certainly, the doctors are not taking the time to go after the cause. When a patient comes in the room, what the doctor is immediately thinking, what pill or what procedure can I give this person to get them out of the room as fast as possible so I can see the next patient? It's a money-driven system, and it is not about outcomes. It is about money, where the doctors are prescribing the pills, the procedures, and it is not about the patient. It is not about quality. It is not about finding the cause. And it's the patients that are suffering in this system.
Are you enjoying episode 4 thus far? Have you learned some valuable information? Do you want to join our movement and support our mission to educate the world on the truth about vaccines? Then please consider supporting our cause by owning the complete series today. Your support allows us to continue to spread the truth for free. Also, a portion of each sale is donated to charities that are doing real research to help our children be healthier and safer. Simply click the banner below to join the movement and support our mission. Thanks in advance. Let's get back to episode number 4 and learn more life-saving information on vaccines.
Just to speak about the financial incentive to vaccinate. So I'm a busy pediatrician. I have 13,000 patients. And I started my practice 8 years ago with about 1,000 patients.
Dr. Paul Thomas.
Practice. So we've grown from 1,000 to 13,000. We've got a selective schedule. We've got an informed consent process that results in, you know, less than CDC schedule vaccinating, right? Probably less than half of the CDC doses are given here. So we're still vaccinating, but we're vaccinating quite a bit less. And I've done the crude math on it. I've lost over $1 million just in administration fees. So for each time my nurse gives a vaccine, there's an average reimbursement of somewhere around $12 to $14. And if you're giving two vaccines, that's double that, or in other practices where they're giving six different vaccines for a 2-month-old, multiply 12 to 14 times six, and then you multiply that by all those recurring visits. It's a huge moneymaker for pediatricians, even though they don't like to admit it. They don't want to acknowledge that they're making money on vaccines. It's a huge part of your bottom line. Pediatric practices are very expensive to run. We have, you know, nurses giving advice. We have doing referrals. We have billing costs and reception costs. I mean, you know, there's huge overhead. It usually runs around 80% for most practices. And so most pediatricians wouldn't survive without the income that comes from vaccines.
It takes conviction and fortitude to deviate from the CDC schedule, especially if you're a pediatrician. The financial incentives and the penalties are tremendous. While countries like Japan have delayed vaccine schedules, in places like the USA and Australia, that choice is not readily available.
41st minute, I'm stopping. Continuation of episode 4, vaccines, starting at 41 minutes.
In Japan, what happened is the vaccination, children are vaccinated against the three type of vaccination they're given to children. But by the time they're about 2 years of age, not below 2 years, because at between birth and 2 years of age, the immune system of these children develops in a way that is able to, you know, to protect the child and for the child to be able to actually deal with the vaccination. Now, in some countries, this is not the case, that the age is actually lowered, so much so that there are other countries where vaccination is given at birth. And so there have been some statistics that have proven that those population where the vaccination was given very, very, very early on in life, those children didn't do very well. So at the end of the day, it would be best, parents choose when or if even to have their children vaccinated. And this is a situation that in some countries like Australia was available, you know, the choice was still available, but now this choice has been is no longer there.
It's not only the USA that offers incentives for vaccinating and actually penalizes for failure to vaccinate according to the full schedule. In 2016, Australia implemented what they call the no jab, no pay policy. I want to read a couple of snippets from that document for you. Here it is. Only parents of children less than 20 years of age who are fully immunized or are on a recognized catch-up schedule can receive the child care benefit or the child care rebate and the family tax benefit, Part A, of the year-end supplement. The relevant vaccinations are those under the National Immunization Program, NIP, which covers the vaccines usually administered before age 5. These vaccinations must be recorded on the Australian Childhood Immunization Register, the ACIR. Conscientious objection and vaccination objection on non-medical grounds will no longer be a valid exemption from immunization requirements. Two vaccines that are part of the Australia vaccine schedule and the CDC vaccine schedule are the vaccine for Haemophilus influenza type B, the HIV vaccine, and the pneumococcal vaccine, Prevnar. Both of these vaccines are for protection from meningitis, among other things.
Take the HIV. I was in training in California the year that was introduced. 1987 in Fresno, California was when we introduced it. And it came down from the CDC, do it, and we just did it. The CDC knows best, and that's how it always has been for pediatricians. The CDC says do, we jump. And we just take it at face value, it's the right thing to do. They've done the research. And in that particular case, I'm a brand new, you know, medical school graduate, and I'm being told this is a great idea, and actually At that time, we were seeing a lot of meningitis from Haemophilus type B. I mean, a lot. As a resident, I was doing lumbar punctures where you put a needle in the spine.
Dr. Paul Thomas.
Send it off to the lab. 3 to 6 a night. You know, these would really sick kids in the emergency room. You'd get called from your, you know, you're on call. You're basically not sleeping, but you'd try. And you'd stumble down and do a lumbar puncture and start them on antibiotics. And you know, hospitals had a lot of kids with meningitis back then. We used to see epiglottitis. That little thing in the back of your throat would get really swollen. You'd have to intubate them to make sure they were okay so they didn't obstruct their airway. We saw cases of that. Those things are gone today. I mean, you almost never see bacterial meningitis. You certainly didn't see type B, all right? And that vaccine didn't have aluminum, didn't have mercury, so it felt like it was a pretty safe vaccine. It did have formaldehyde, which is not a great thing to be injecting. But I palpably saw a huge drop in meningitis that following year after we instituted that. And some of the data showed that to be the case. So man, I'm a believer, right? I mean, this is amazing. So it just reinforced my belief in vaccines. What we need to know, though, today, if you're going to give informed consent, so I've got, you're my parent, and we've got your two-month-old baby, and we're going to talk about the Hib. What you need to know, and this data is on the CDC website, that Haemophilus influenza type B, that's Hib, causes only a handful of cases of disease, serious disease, a year in the United States. So again, it's one of those one in a million cases. Now, there might be 200 to 400 cases of Haemophilus meningitis non-typable, or other, right, but not type B. Why is that? It possibly is that that vaccine was so effective that we don't see that strain anymore, right? And that happened with the Prevnar. We used to have a Prevnar 7, that's pneumococcal, the other major cause of meningitis and serious bacterial disease, and we started seeing other strains. So they came out with the Prevnar 13. Will there be a Prevnar 21? I don't know. You know, we keep chasing these things as they shift. So for informed consent for the Hib, some families who are really averse to vaccines, they're just afraid that it's overstimulating their child's immune system and they want natural immunity, they might be comfortable with that risk of one in a million from type B.
The mere injection of material into the body is a medical problem. Because you will always, always create an inflammatory response and the body's need to reject that material and attack it. Why do you think we're having so many food allergies?
Dr. Larry Pilevsky.
Starting from the vitamin K shot that babies are given at birth.
What's in the vitamin K?
Egg phospholipid. And castor oil. And all you have to do is do a literature search. Does castor oil cross-react with peanuts and tree nuts? And the answer is yes.
Allergies were unheard of before the invention of the hypodermic needle. Allergies were not even a known phenomenon. So you think about hypodermic means under the skin, so you're taking a substance, it's coming through a needle, going under your skin into your body in an unnatural way, not entering through the nose or the mouth. And this is the genesis of the birth of allergies. Heather Fraser was a historian. She wasn't a medical person, but her own son, when she first gave him a peanut around the age of one, he had an anaphylactic reaction, and she didn't understand why her son was allergic to peanuts the way, of course, many other children are as well. And she did a deep dive into the research and wrote this book, The Peanut Allergy Epidemic, which has so many references, very well researched. And she uncovered the fact that the Hib vaccine, the Haemophilus influenza B vaccine, which is one of the vaccines that's given for meningitis and invasive bacteria that can cause, you know, other illnesses. And I don't make light of Haemophilus illnesses because they can be very serious. However, they're typically rare and uncommon. Anyway, she discovered that, well, there's a couple of issues. One is that they use oils, including peanut oil, sometimes in adjuvants of vaccines. So one, some of the ingredients can be peanut or other nut-containing oils. And of course, these things are trade secrets. They don't just, you know, disclose that so easily.
Well, that makes sense about the peanut allergy then.
Yeah, but also the Hib bacterium, the molecular weight and the molecular structure of some of the proteins in that bacterium are very similar to that of a peanut. So there's a cross-reaction. So here you are taking this injection a series of four injections over time, and your body's mounting this immune response that is, you know, supposed to go on, and the inflammation and all that. Then you eat a peanut, the body gets confused and thinks, oh, this is the thing I'm supposed to have a big reaction to, and then you have this, life-threatening or less than life-threatening reaction to a peanut.
Dr. Levitin spoke about food allergies, specifically peanut allergies, which are pervasive today. She also discussed the Hib vaccine, which can cause peanut allergies. Dr. Pilevsky also spoke about food allergies, and he mentioned specifically the vitamin K shot. Many people do not realize that newborns receive a vitamin K shot at birth, even though it's been administered since 1961 by recommendation of the AAP, the American Academy of Pediatrics. According to the CDC, babies are born deficient in vitamin K, and without enough vitamin K, they can't make enough substances that are used to form clots, and they are at risk for vitamin K deficiency bleeding, or VKDB. A vitamin K shot given at birth is the best way to prevent VKDB and assist the newborn with blood clotting capabilities.
In rare instances, kids can be born with a bleeding diathesis or a bleeding pathology called VKDB, which basically means that they don't have enough vitamin K. Vitamin K is extremely important in the ability to clot, to basically clot and stop bleeding if you're internal bleeding or external bleeding, if you have a cut on your skin. And so they're given a synthetic drug. The generic name is phytanidione. Why inject a child with a liquid substance, with a vaccine-like substance that contains aluminum, benzyl alcohol, and propylene glycol, which is antifreeze, when you can get the same, honestly better, source of vitamin K through diet? The mother can eat green leafy vegetables for a period of weeks before the child is born. The vitamin K from that would be transferred through the placenta. You could give an oral form of vitamin K as opposed to an injection. And although that's not going to be absorbed probably in the gut as well as transfer from the placenta, another completely reasonable way to get vitamin K into the child to have normal clotting for a problem that doesn't occur that often to begin with. I mean, most kids, I don't think that VKDB, vitamin K deficient bleeding, is that common. It's another opportunity to inject a child with pharmaceuticals, my opinion.
Dr. Sani mentioned the generic name of vitamin K, which is phytonadione. On the package insert, there's actually a black box warning. An alternative to the vitamin K shot is oral vitamin K. There have been no studies indicating that oral vitamin K causes childhood cancer. However, a 1992 study in the British Medical Journal was the second study to confirm a link between the vitamin K shot and childhood cancer.
Oh my God.
I want to read the conclusion of this study. The only two studies so far to have examined the relation between childhood cancer and intramuscular vitamin K have shown similar results, and the relation is biologically plausible. The prophylactic benefits against hemorrhagic disease are unlikely to exceed the potential adverse effects from intramuscular vitamin K. Since oral vitamin K has major benefits but no obvious adverse effects, this could be the prophylactic's choice. At the beginning of the last segment, Dr. Paul Thomas mentioned Prevnar. Let's learn about this pneumococcal vaccine.
Do you have this with the pneumococcal family? Okay, multiple strains. They're giving a pneumococcal vaccine.
Neil Miller, originally they came out medical with journalist.
Okay, it was a vaccine that was developed to combat 7 out of more than 90 different pneumococcal strains that are capable of causing pneumococcal disease. Within a few years of targeting 7 strains of pneumococcal disease, those strains were knocked out, but new strains became more virulent, became more prevalent and more virulent. New strains took their place. Strains that weren't causing a problem in the past, now those are the strains that are causing problems. Why do you think they came out with the new and improved Prevnar 13? It's PCV13. It's because they said, here's the new strains that are causing the problems. And it only took place in a few small years. And so they said, we have to add 6 more strains. So we went from Prevnar 7 to Prevnar 13. But within 2 years of Prevnar 13 being on the market, those little buggers, those microorganisms, quickly adapted. And there's now already new strains that are taking the place of the 13 strains.
I was on a consumer member of the FDA Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee when the Prevnar vaccine came through, the original one, the Prevnar 7.
What's Prevnar 4?
That's pneumococcal vaccine. I sat there, I looked at the information.
Barbara Fisher, President, National Vaccine Information Center.
The vaccine for this was an experimental meningococcal vaccine. They didn't know the reaction profile of the meningococcal vaccine, and they had an experimental pneumococcal vaccine, Prevnar. They didn't know the reaction profile of that vaccine. They gave the children in both arms a DPT vaccine. Every time a seizure occurred, they wrote it off as DPT, not as the vaccine they were trying to license in the experimental vaccine that was a control.
Now, there was no control.
How can you figure out if you're not in a science experiment? In eighth grade, you're taught that when you conduct a science experiment and try to figure out what's happening, you have to have the experimental arm and you have to have a control that is not active. Otherwise, how do you understand what the reaction profile is?
In clinical trials for Prevnar 13, which is the newest pneumococcal vaccine, the Prevnar 7 vaccine was used as the placebo. And the placebo for the Prevnar 7 vaccine was an investigational meningococcal vaccine. So Prevnar has really never been studied with a true placebo control group. Barbara Lowe Fisher mentioned the term reaction profile, and that made me think of a common recommendation from pediatricians if a child is having a reaction to the toxins in a vaccine. What do? You give them acetaminophen. I can't count the number of times that we gave our children a dose of children's Tylenol, which is acetaminophen.
It's crucial that a child be able to effectively detox from those ingredients. What is one of the biggest ways you can compromise a child's ability to detox? Give them acetaminophen, the main ingredient in Tylenol. So I just interviewed a mom with a 4-month-old baby. The baby screamed for 24 hours. She called her pediatrician and she said, "What should I do?" And the pediatrician said, "That's normal. That's a normal vaccine reaction to scream for 24 hours without stopping. Give the baby some Tylenol." The last thing you ever want to do is give Tylenol to a baby who's just been vaccinated. You're basically guaranteeing that that baby's going to have more trouble detoxing. So what happens with acetaminophen is that it's processed in the liver. The liver, it depletes your body of glutathione. Glutathione is an enzyme that you need to help you rid yourself of toxins. Think of it as nature's mop or nature's broom. It's the thing that gets rid of the toxins. When you give a child acetaminophen, you're compromising their liver's ability to produce glutathione, which is compromising their body's ability to detoxify. It's a perfect storm.
1959, Tylenol was introduced, and it was heavily pushed as a replacement for aspirin. I grew up on Tylenol. Every time I had a sniffle, I had Tylenol. And the 80s, 90s, we started with the increasing vaccinations. So for three generations, we're seeing children are losing their sense of heat. And what we're seeing is each generation goes by, we're seeing an increased amount of dysfunctions that I say are all related to lack of heat. And so that's everything from stillbirths to SIDS to autism to ADHD, asthma. These are all diseases from lack of heat. There's also a bunch of data right now in the literature about pregnant women that use acetaminophen while they are pregnant or shortly after, their children do have increased asthma, ADHD, behavioral disorders, sensory disorders.
There's actually a study coming out from a team of researchers from Duke and Harvard University. It'll be published in the next few weeks, and it shows all of the, it's a huge literature review of everything we know about acetaminophen, the main ingredient in Tylenol, and it's very, very concerning. We have in vivo studies, meaning in petri dishes. We have studies in epidemiology that shows that the more exposure to Tylenol, the worse the health outcomes. Children should never take Tylenol. And unfortunately, most doctors are not keeping up with the scientific literature. They have no idea how dangerous acetaminophen is.
You know, I'm seeing a little bit of a trend of reversal. Within the last 5 years, I know within the anesthesia world, we have decreased the amount of Tylenol and the incidence of where we're going to use it right away. So maybe they might hold off a little bit. We've seen that pediatricians now, the standard of care is to not give pre-dosing Tylenol for vaccinations. Now, there are still a lot of pediatricians that are recommending that, but the standard of care, based on studies, is to not give Tylenol before or after a vaccine, because that is proven scientifically. NIH study to increase the risk of autism.
I went back and I read every single study, Ty. I mean, mean, I went back and I print the studies off. I get a yellow highlighter and I work through them and I read them more than once. You have to read beyond the headline of a scientific study. You have to read beyond the abstract and you have to delve into the science and take a look at it. And we also know that the negative effects of acetaminophen are magnified in the presence of testosterone. And that to me is fascinating because one of the conundrums with autism is why so many more boys than girls? Why so many more boys than girls? And acetaminophen might be one of the reasons, because the negative effects of acetaminophen are enhanced by the presence of testosterone.
We've had 20 years of epidemic autism, 20 years at least.
Jeffrey Jackson, J-A-X-E-N, journalist, investigative.
And injured parents and children with vaccine injury will never give up. So every child that has a vaccine injury is creating a warrior in the child and a soldier in the mother. And these soldiers will fight to the death. And they're lining up continuously, row after row. And what's in front of them is a paper tiger with some money behind it of a corporation that's a transparent entity, and it can't last against that.
No child is born with an intact immune system. The immune system of a child is struggling, literally struggling into existence for the first 2 years. And that's why most countries in the world don't vaccinate before the child is 2 years old, and their incidence of autism and vaccine injury is much, much less than the United States. I just came back from a 2-week lecture tour in Europe, and in most countries of the world, they get about half of what American kids get.
I saw a survey recently where over 5 million people had voted, and 70% supported a federal mandate for vaccinating children on the CDC schedule.
Brandy Vaughn
would be 72 before 18.
Vaccine activist.
The first year of life, which is unheard of in any other country. And we have some of the highest infant mortality rates, highest SIDS rates. Not a coincidence.
In 2011, Neil Miller and Dr. Gary Goldman published a study that compared worldwide infant mortality rates and the number of vaccine doses in those infants.
Dr. Gary Goldman and I did another study. And in this other study, what we did is we looked at the vaccination schedules of nations around the world. And we found that the United States requires the most vaccines. So we wanted to see if the United States has the best infant mortality rate, because we were told by authorities that vaccines are life-saving. That's why they're giving them. They're giving vaccines to babies to protect them from dying from infectious diseases. So that was our premise. That's what we wanted to look at. Let's look at the immunization schedules of different nations around the world. How many vaccines do they require? Because in the United States, they were requiring 26 vaccines for infants. And infant is defined by any baby up to 1 year of age. So, and that's how the infant mortality rate is measured, by how many deaths per country, per 1,000 live births are there, okay? And it's a good measure of the socioeconomic and health conditions of a nation. Some nations, like Iceland and other European and certain European nations, they require as few as only 12 vaccines for their infants. So we wanted to look at, is there a difference between a nation that requires 12 vaccines versus a nation that requires 26 vaccines of their infants? Okay? And we only wanted to look at essentially first world nations. And so what we found was that the United States had the 34th worst infant mortality rate in the world. The 34th. So there were 33 nations that had better infant mortality rates than the United States. And yet the United States requires the most vaccines for their infants. And what we found was that we found a statistically significant correlation between the number of vaccine doses that a nation requires and that nation's infant mortality rate. The more vaccines that a nation requires, that a first world nation requires, the worse infant mortality rate that it actually has. The fewest vaccines that a first world nation requires was associated with the best infant mortality rates. Mm. These were published in peer-reviewed journals. So anybody that wants to go and access those studies, they can read them.
In Miller and Goldman's study, which included the countries with the lowest infant mortality rates and the fewest number of infant vaccines, Iceland and Norway were two of the five countries. But that's not the only thing that Iceland and Norway had in common.
So when I was doing research for my last book, I went to Norway and I went to Iceland. And I sat down with the Surgeon General of Iceland and I said, "Do you mandate vaccines?" And he looked at me like I said, "Do you have three heads?" Because they have a much gentler, more evidence-based vaccine schedule. They said we would never dictate what vaccines were chosen, but most people follow the schedule. So if people in America aren't following the vaccine schedule, that doesn't make me think there's something wrong with those people. That makes me ask the question, what is going wrong with our vaccine schedule? Is there something wrong with our schedule that's making it hard for people to follow? So when I was in Norway, I visited the hospitals, and I also interviewed many doctors, and the Norwegian breastfeeding rates are something like 99%. So women in Norway who are really encouraged to breastfeed, but really interesting about Norway is that at 6 months, the vast majority of babies are still being breastfed. So if you go to Norway, it's absolutely normal to see these beautiful Norwegian mamas with their babies breastfeeding.
Could the 99% breastfeeding rates in Iceland and Norway be one of the reasons for their low infant mortality? Another interesting fact about Iceland and Norway is that according to a 2009 report entitled Autism and Vaccines Around the World, their rates of autism were 1 in 1,100 and 1 in 2,000 respectively. At that time, the USA's autism rate was 1 in 150. Now it's estimated to be around 1 in 50.
We've gone from 1 in 10,000 children with autism in the 1970s, 80s, to now we're at 1 in 45 children based on a poll last year. And you talk to doctors that are directly involved in this, like, it looks like 1 in 25 children this year maybe, you know, end up on the autism spectrum. And in our film, we have an MIT mathematician and scientist that just graphs out, just based on the CDC's numbers, where this is going. If it is not stopped, if this exponential rise does not stop, we'll be at 1 in 2 children by 2032. That's the end of a society.
Do you think there's enough evidence now that you could prosecute vaccines in a court of law?
In my humble opinion, yes. I mean, we go on circumstantial evidence all the time. We don't, direct evidence is someone that says, hey, we have blood, we have DNA, we have gunshot powder residue on your hand.
DA, Texas. Davi, D-A-V-I.
The murder. You saw that the incident happen. And then you have hearsay. Well, I heard someone else say that's not admissible in court. And so I get that. But we look at circumstances.
2032. That's the end of the society.
Do you think there's enough evidence now that you could prosecute vaccines in a court of law?
In my humble opinion, yes. I mean, we go.
Davi Lahood, D-A-V-I. L-A-H-O-O-D.
We have blood, we have DNA, we have gunshot powder residue on your hands. That's direct evidence. And then you have testimonial evidence, like you saw the murder, you saw the incident happen. And then you have hearsay. Well, I heard someone else say that's not admissible in court. And so I get that. But we look at circumstantial evidence. Someone walks into a house, there's gunshots, and then the person walks out the back, and you walk in behind that person, and there's someone passed away in the house. Well, you didn't see the person shoot the person in the house. You heard shots, you saw them walk in, you saw them walk out, and there's no one else in the house, and then you have a dead body. That's circumstantial evidence that that person committed the murder. Now, does that mean we don't prosecute that case? Of course not. We prosecute the case. So in analyzing this case, I look at the high level of vaccines that have entered into our children's lives. I look at the high rate of autism. That's correlation. I agree. That doesn't mean it's necessarily causation, but that means investigation. We need to continue to investigate.
It's not only autism. You know, there's like vaccine injuries that happen immediately that, just paralysis, like even to like death and other stuff that, you know, causes those injuries like right away, and they're immediate as well. You know, I mean, we were able to see our son because of the developmental issue, but there's been other and stories of people that have come out and told us that we even know that we didn't know that we're going through that stuff. And that's kind of, I think, even though it's been so hard because everything, you know, that has been said about us and like, what are you guys, you know, it's like Nico said, this is our story. We're living it. This is our son, you know, and as hard as it is to take it, I'm also grateful because what is that to other families? It's made them question and have those, know that they have a choice for now. I mean, at least we do. And just have that question, you know, ask about it, think about your kids, think about your, you know, we think about our son every day, and I wish now it would have been different back then. Somebody had told me all of this, because that wasn't there, but we just going what we were told, but there wasn't, I didn't educate myself as much as I should have, I think.
We lived with that guilt tie for a long time. Me as a protector, I think to myself, man, I didn't protect my son, you know. It's hard for me, and we prayed about it. You know, the Lord has revealed us and said, look, it's not your fault. You made the best decision you could at the time with the information provided to you at that time. And we get that now, but it's still hard in the flesh. You know, I can see Davi gets emotional.
There's numerous studies that document correlations between the vaccines and autism. When the health authorities tell you that there's no link between vaccines and autism, they're lying to you. There's numerous studies that are providing significant evidence that there's a link between vaccines and autism.
We must protect our children. They're weak and they're vulnerable and they need us. But in our attempts to protect them and keep them healthy with vaccines, have we done more harm than good?
There's actually a gentleman I just met today named Edwin Black. He wrote a book called War Against the Weak. We have a sorry history in this country of how we handled the most vulnerable among us. And you're right, the measure of the standards, the measure of our society, is how we handle, how we treat, how we care for those who are vulnerable. We're not doing a very good job of that. And there is maybe another war against the weak, because the children, the cohort of children with developmental disabilities over the last 20 years is not being provided for. And we are in a catastrophe. We've been warning about this for 15 years or more. Dan Burton, a courageous congressman, had hearings back in 99, 2000, 2001, saying what's going to happen to these kids. So now we're 15 years forward. Almost nothing's been done.
But I do know that one of Germany's most vicious eugenicists, Mengele, chose as a course of investigation vaccinating people with viruses. He would vaccinate the twins and then see how one twin responded as opposed to the other.
Edwin Black, New York Times investigative author.
Then do live autopsies to attempt to make his clinical reports.
The Nuremberg Code from 1947, which two Americans helped to write, was supposed to prevent and forever, forever avoid forced medicine of any form, including experimental medicine, and vaccines most certainly fall into the category of experimental medicine, and your children are the guinea pigs.
If you look at the history of government oppression, I believe Chairman Mao of Communist China said the ultimate expression of political will is at the end of a gun, and that is what the vaccine industry is now turning to. The same tools of Adolf Hitler and the Holocaust and Mao and the communist purging of people, this is what the vaccine industry has become. Invoking violence with guns and threats and turning healthy people into disabled, handicapped people, harming children, killing children, suppressing science, suppressing voices, committing scientific fraud, covering up the information that could shine light on this. That's what the vaccine industry has become today. It is a criminal enterprise committing mass violence against innocent people everywhere around the world. There will be a day, I believe, when those who have committed medical violence against our children in the form of vaccines will be held accountable. Perhaps in their own lifetimes, with prosecutions of crimes against humanity. But even if that doesn't happen, they will be judged beyond this life. There's a spiritual judgment. What you do matters. And if you harm children in this world, you will be held accountable beyond this world.
When I worked on the doctors, we literally said, this is a medical fact. They are saying in medicine in this country, this will be the first generation of children that does not live to be as old as their parents. Why would we listen to
Del Bigtree?
Why would we listen to any of these doctors? Why would we trust them? We also know that the third leading cause of death now is hospitals themselves. Between 250 and 400,000 people every year in America are killed in hospitals. You know, die for reasons other than they went into the hospital. Medical mistakes, MRSA, getting, you know, bacterial infections that can't be stopped. I mean, the list goes on and on. I mean, and put that in perspective. We had like 65,000 people die in Vietnam, and the 60s erupted, and people were screaming and yelling and marching in the streets. We have 250,000 to 400,000 people dying in hospitals for no reason, and nobody even cares.
Every year.
Every year.
We must continue to facilitate debate on this vitally important issue of vaccines to see how we can help save our children and help them to have long, healthy lives. Are you familiar with the concept of herd immunity?
The concept of herd immunity is based on the idea that contagiousness is the only way for disease to spread. It's based on the idea that the only way I can get sick, the only way I'm exposed to the germ, is if you who are sick give it to me. As if there's no other possible way I could be exposed to that germ without being exposed to someone who's sick. That is the biggest problem regarding infectious diseases, contagiousness, and herd immunity. Because it doesn't allow for all the permutations, all the ways in which you could have a germ in your body and still not get sick, that you could be exposed to a germ from the environment without having been near anyone who had the illness. As if the only vector of exposure is someone who's sick.
I've started looking at pertussis and pertussis vaccine back in 1982, and really the story has come full circle in the 21st century, because what we know now is that DPT vaccine, the whole cell vaccine that hurt my son, that was introduced in the late 1940s in this country and used on a mass basis, and the DTaP vaccine that replaced DPT in the late 90s, neither of those vaccines could prevent infection and transmission of infection by vaccinated persons. What you have is a lot of people who have been vaccinated who have mild symptoms or are asymptomatic, no symptoms at all, who can become infected and transmit to both vaccinated and unvaccinated people. So it's an illusion that there is vaccine-acquired herd immunity, and it's always been an illusion, because the microbe has responded to the mass vaccination and has evolved, created strains that are not covered in the vaccine. That's one thing. The other thing is that immunity, vaccine-acquired immunity, is extremely temporary, if at all, perhaps less than 2 years. So you have a lot of pertussis in our country, but it's not being identified and it's not being reported. You're seeing a rise in pertussis now, reports, because there are cases that are symptomatic are being diagnosed, but you cannot say that pertussis vaccine is preventing pertussis in this country, and therefore you cannot claim that there is herd immunity from pertussis vaccine.
There's some really systemic problems with the vaccine industry, and we need to really take a look at it.
And people have that right. We should still have that right to ask questions, to say, I want to know what is in this vaccine that's going to go into my child. And I think for too long we have been made to feel you can't ask that. You can't ask a doctor that. We just have to trust. And I'm sorry, as a parent, I don't just freely give my trust about my children to anyone.
So what I would tell parents is that they need to trust themselves. And you know your child better than anyone else in the world, and you know your family better than anyone else in the world. And actually, we should not be trusting government agencies to tell us what to do with our children. We should be trusting ourselves. And we should be finding medical professionals who we can trust, who we can make collaborative decisions with about our children's health. So the CDC does not know better. Your child's teacher does not know better. And even your doctor does not know better. You're on the ground every day, boots to the ground, with your baby, with your child, and you're the person you should trust.
There are profound and potentially irreversible damages.
Joseph McCullough.
And it's just all about analyzing very carefully the cost-risk-benefit analysis. So So in some cases it may be warranted. It's the parent you need to make the decision, but you've got to do the homework. No one has done the homework, virtually no one. I mean, it's clearly under 1%. My guess is under 0.1%. They just don't have time. You have to trust the experts, because there's not time to validate everything by yourself. So, and this is one of the most firmly entrenched positions in the healthcare system.
Some doctors who are really smart can't hear it. They can't hear it, and I'm like, okay, you know, they're yelling at me, like, you're a quack, and you're dangerous, and you're killing patients. And I'll say, okay, what's VIRS? What's the table of injuries? What's a varicell? What's a passage?
They don't know.
Who sits on the ASIP committee? What is the ASIP committee? What's VRBAC? And they don't know. They look at me, what's adversonomics? What is the science of adversonomics? They don't know any of it. And I'm like, you don't know anything. Oh no, we studied immunology. I said, I studied the same immunology in medical school. We don't study innate immunity.
Right?
And we study theoretically how vaccines work. And then we have to memorize a schedule. That's not studying vaccines. You can't tell me the ingredient list. You don't know what foreign DNA is in there.
It really all comes down to, you know, we hold doctors in this extreme high esteem, because I think we look at the fact that they've gone to 8 years of medical school as like, I didn't get that much education. They're so much smarter than me. I'm just going to defer to whatever they said. But I have a test for anyone that actually thinks like that. I want you to ask the doctor that's about to inject your child with a vaccine one question. Please list for me the ingredients in the vaccine you're about to give my baby. And I assure you that over 90% of the doctors will not be able to list those ingredients for you. I've tried it. They'll say, well, I know that there's certain adjuvants and there's certain ingredients, and I have a manual that sort of explains it. No, I didn't ask about a manual. There are only 16 vaccines. We give 72 doses right now of 16 current vaccines. I would assume that in your 8 years of studying, you learn how to memorize text. You certainly learn how to memorize 16 different vaccines, I would think, because my mechanic down the street, if I ask him about the distance of the thread gap on a screw in a certain part of my engine, they can tell me. They can tell me about the viscosity oil. They can tell me about every single nut, the hex size of the nut head. Or I can go to my chef. I can go to the chef down the street and ask him to list every ingredient of the cake he just baked. He not only will tell me the ingredients, he'll tell me when they went in, whether they got folded, mixed, or stirred, what the temperature of the oven. Most of them will probably even tell me the science of how the oven interacts in the heat and why they choose the temperature they do. So everyone in their business knows everything about their business except doctors with vaccines. It's incredible to me. It's incredibly sad. You cannot tell me that you're doing your job if you cannot list the ingredients. As a pediatrician, you really only do three things. You measure the head of your baby, of our baby, you weigh that baby, and then you start injecting them with vaccines. And you're telling me in your 10 years, in your 20 years, and maybe your 30 years of being a pediatrician, you have never taken the time to sit with that vaccine insert and read every single ingredient and memorize it, and then ask yourself, what is the safety? What is the safety testing on these ingredients? I'm not even going that far. I'm not even asking you to study all the safety tests that should have been done on aluminum, on formaldehyde, on all these things that we would send products back to China if it was on a toy but we're injecting it into babies. I'm not even asking you to understand that. I'm asking you to know what the ingredients are. And the fact that you cannot list that for a parent that is trusting their day one old baby, their 2 month old baby, their 4 month old baby, they're handing it to you because they trusted you did that job for them. And if you haven't done that job, I don't know how you live with yourself, because I wouldn't be able to live with myself. I don't do a job and say, well, my boss knows the answer to that. I don't, but I continue on as I am. You're a doctor. You're supposed to know. You were educated to think, you were educated to study, and you were educated to memorize things. Please do the same job my mechanic's done and know those ingredients.
I think a lot of people have been asleep. I don't think they have really understood what has been happening over the last 30 years. As more people have become aware that vaccines can cause brain and immune system dysfunction, as more children are born healthy, they get vaccinated and are never healthy again. We have seen the infrastructure, instead of doing what they should do, and that is doing the proper science, being partners with parents in preventing vaccine injury and death. They've taken a hardline approach. It's either my way or the highway. You either do it or we're going to punish you. If you don't do it the way we say you should do it, we're going to punish you. with societal sanctions, like no shots, no school, no shots, no medical care, no shots, no health insurance, no shots, no job. This is a very serious situation. And if we don't stand up now and fight for our freedom, we're going to find ourselves in chains for the next century.
Thanks again, everyone, for watching tonight's episode. I hope you learned a lot, and I really hope that you're going to tell your friends and your family about it, and you're going to tune back in for the next episode.